I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. There is a demographic inversion taking place in America, according to Alan Ehrenhalt, and he is here to tell us about it. Alan is executive editor of Governing Magazine, and in an article last month for The New Republic, he contends that we are beginning to see a new trend in America where people with financial options about where they live are moving to cities, while those with less money are moving to the edges of metro areas. We'll find out why and what it means today on Smart City. We'll also talk with Harry Boyd about the many ways Americans are now asserting themselves as citizens to shape their communities, which he documents in his new book, The Citizen Solution. Plus Walker Smith's City Views and the latest news from Planetizen coming up on today's Smart City, right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Alan Ehrenhalt is executive editor of Governing Magazine, which gives him unique insight into the ways cities work. Last month, writing in The New Republic, Alan identified a growing trend of cities reversing decades of affluent flight, which he calls demographic inversion. Alan, in The New Republic this month, you wrote about the demographic inversion of the American city. What happened?
Well, the demographic inversion is pretty simple. It basically means that the pattern of the last half century in which we've gotten so used to, that is, affluent people moving out of the city and into the suburbs and the inner city being the preserve of poor people, is gradually being reversed. And over the course of the next generation, I do predict, city centers will be the place where people who have a choice, namely more affluent people, can live, and newcomers, immigrants, and the poor are more likely to live on the outskirts. And in fact, that's what cities historically have been like. If you think about 19th century Paris or Vienna, rich people lived on the inside and poorer people and immigrants lived on the outside. 30 years ago, there was an election for mayor in Chicago. Michael Bolandic was the incumbent. The primary was in March. He was running against Jane Byrne. In February, there's 20 inches of snow. And the CTA isn't running very well. It doesn't run very well now, but it really wasn't running very well in a snowstorm. And so the trains would fill up in the outer stations toward the suburbs with middle-class white people. And by the time they got to the inner city, they were so full they weren't even stopping. And blacks and Hispanics got so angry that they took their anger out on Bolandic, and he was beaten in the primary by Jane Byrne. Well, I tell the story, and then I say, this couldn't happen now. And that's not because of climate change, and it's not because the CTA works perfectly. It's because the people left stranded in the inner city would be all the rich people, because that's who's living there now, and the train would be filled with immigrants and poorer people getting on at the further reaches of the city.
How did this happen?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I think it's happened for a lot of reasons. The one people are going to think of most immediately is $4 and maybe at some point $5 a gallon gasoline, but that clearly isn't most of it because things don't happen that fast and gas hasn't been that expensive that long. If you think about the way cities have changed since the 1970s, there are a couple of things that are worth mentioning. One is that they are not, for the most part, grimy industrial precincts the way they were 100 years ago. We don't make much of anything in cities anymore. So the kind of noisy, dirty, somewhat off-putting environment that confronted anybody who came to an inner city or a downtown in the early 20th century or through the mid-20th century especially, that's pretty much gone. You know, and that's a mixed blessing. If you're in Detroit, you're not too happy about manufacturing having departed. But it has created the possibility of a more livable inner city. Second, anybody who's middle-aged these days knows what it was like 30 years ago to walk the streets of a central city and to be nervous about the person who was behind you and thinking there was a pretty good chance of you're being mugged. That's a fear that has largely gone away since the early 1990s. Crime rates are much lower than they were. Random crime rates are much, much lower than they were. And my experience in particular is that people under 25 have absolutely no fear or virtually no fear of random crime in the inner city. In Washington, D.C., where I am now, 14th and U Streets, which was the old riot corridor, 1968 is the hottest clubs scene for affluent kids. Which brings up the final point that I'll make on this, that you've got a generation of kids raised in the suburbs with a vague sense that the excitement is in the city, and who don't have much, who aren't much drawn to cul-de-sac suburbia. And we could talk about why that's true, but one of the most popular television programs in that age demographic been in the last decade, things like Seinfeld, Friends, Sex and the City. It hasn't been the Brady Bunch or some new version of it. So lots of things seem to be working together. I'm not arguing that television shows are bringing the cities back. I'm merely saying that all of this seems fits together and doesn't necessarily mean that all cities are recovering or that there is a renaissance. I'm fairly careful in avoiding that kind of blanket statement. I'm not a cheerleader. Merely that I think increasingly we will see that people who have a choice will choose to live in the center, and people who have less of a choice will be forced to live further away.
Where is the trend today evident? You say it's not a renaissance, but there are signs. Where are those signs showing?
Well, one of them, interestingly, is in the take the financial district in New York. You know, 2001, there were something like 15,000 people living in Manhattan at the southern tip below the World Trade Center. Now there are probably 60,000. If you walk down Wall Street, on the south side of that street, every building except the New York Stock Exchange is a residence. It's remarkable. Now, does that mean there are 10 years from now there aren't going to be any brokerage houses in the financial district? Of course not. I mean, there's always going to be a commercial presence, but one would have to be ignorant of what's going on not to notice that a place like Wall Street, which in many ways is not the most convenient place to live, is becoming enormously attractive to people who work there and want to be there. And I should add, can afford to be there, because the average income of the residents of that area is something like, I think the median income is $162,000. So we're not talking about poor people here, but we're talking about people who have an opportunity to live in the city and want to do it, and they're doing it.
Well, you write that Chicago is gradually coming to resemble a traditional European city, Vienna or Paris,
right,
in the 19th century, or for that matter, Paris today. And we remember what happened in Paris not too many years ago. The poor and the newcomers are living on the outskirts, you write. The people who live near the center are those who can afford to do so, what you've just said. So in your opinion, Alan, is this good for cities or bad for cities?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. It's important to make the distinction between a demographic inversion, that is, affluent people coming to the center, and revival of cities in general. It doesn't necessarily follow that because rich people are on the inside and poor people are coming to be on the outside, that we're having an urban renaissance. Those are two different issues. On the other hand, is it better culturally for the center of cities to revive? I think on balance it is better. I think cities aren't doing a very good job of relocating those who are being dispossessed by gentrification, but I think that can take place, and on the whole, the revival of center cities is something to be optimistic about for this century, and we certainly need a few things to be optimistic about.
Well, that's for sure. But let me push back and or at least try to understand what you're saying here. Demographic inversion doesn't necessarily mean the revival of cities in general. So where's the missing link?
Well, I mean, to some extent, we're seeing a resorting, as Bill Bishop points out in a very good new book called The Big Sort. We're seeing people moving around based on choice and based on ability to relocate where they want to locate. I don't personally consider it a moral issue whether you have rich people in the center and poor people on the outside or vice versa. It may be an economic issue or a demographic issue or even an aesthetic issue. It's not a moral question, in my opinion. What matters is that people, wherever they live, are treated humanely, and that's what's important, and that people who have to leave Soho or Wrigleyville or Lower Manhattan or wherever it is, I have decent places to live. But that's a separate issue. I think that if we're just asking, is it good that the old centers of cities and of urban life are reviving and people with some disposable income are living there, on balance, yes, I think that's a good thing.
And why is it a good thing?
Well, because you have a critical mass for cultural activities, for recreation. You have at least the possibility of reviving the sort of urban community that Jane Jacobs wrote about nearly 50 years ago in The Death and Life of American Cities. She was writing about Greenwich Village and the attempts to bulldoze it, essentially, in the 1960s, which failed. And while Greenwich Village isn't exactly what it was like in Jane Jacobs' day, it's still quite a livable place. There aren't that many Greenwich Villages around the country, but I would say that more central cities are adopting some of the characteristics that Jane Jacobs wrote about, and it gives people who grew up without much face-to-face community in suburbs that are sometimes described as sterile, although I don't like to use that term, but that are sometimes described that way. It gives them a chance for face-to-face community in an urban setting, and I think that's important that we try to revive that in some way.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Alan Ehrenhault about his fascinating article from The New Republic about the demographic inversion taking place in cities. Alan, you note that race is not always the critical issue or even especially relevant in this demographic shift that you write about. And that's a big switch from, say, the forces that produced the original outmigration from cities in the 60s. What do you make of that?
Well, it varies enormously. In lower Manhattan, that not only is there no or almost no racial issue, there's no gentrification issue because nobody was living there. So nobody was forced out of Wall Street because it wasn't a residential neighborhood to begin with. In Atlanta, it's very much a racial situation. Atlanta was 65% African American in 1990, and I believe 30% roughly white. Now it's 55 and 35, and with the difference being made up largely by immigrants who are going to the suburbs, the outer areas of the city, not the central city. So it doesn't take too much extrapolation to figure out that Atlanta will not be a black majority city too much longer. Won't be a white majority city either. It'll be a polyglot city. I'm not sure that's bad. Race is clearly an issue in Atlanta. It's an issue in Philadelphia. Somewhat less so in Chicago. Chicago was never a black majority city. And in Chicago and Atlanta, where there are large middle-class black communities, part of the young affluent inner center city urban class is black or Hispanic, not a majority by any means, but a significant proportion. And so I think you have to look at each city in itself. In a city like Seattle or Portland, race is not a major factor in the return to the city. Some places it is.
Are people surprised by what they find living in cities? Are they still trying to hang on to some hybrid lifestyle complete with car and suburban quiet?
Most people who are willing to move to the central city don't want to give up their cars. In fact, they're putting up a building in Charlotte, downtown Charlotte right now, where you're going to be able to drive into the building garage and the elevator will take your car up to your apartment.
But isn't that the antithesis of what Jane Jacobs anticipated?
I don't know. I mean, it's a little odd. On the other hand, people are moving downtown. Probably most of those people won't commute to work. They'll use the car for recreational purposes. You know, I'm not saying that's the greatest innovation in urban life, although it exists in Europe in a number of places. It doesn't exist in that form here. But the desire of people to live in central cities is not necessarily a desire to give away their cars. I certainly wouldn't claim that it is. The major conflict that you tend to have in some of these cities is you have baby boomers. They move downtown, and then they find that there are nightclubs all around them. And they don't think that's such a bad thing. I mean, it means that they're in a lively, thriving part of the city. But you may have noticed this, nightclubs tend to stay open kind of late, and they're a bit loud. And so you have a clash between the baby boomers who go to bed earlier and earlier, and the kids who want to party later at night. And it reminds me of the people who move out to the country and are surprised that pigs don't smell very good. And by the way, I'm not comparing nightclub goers to pigs in any respect. But people sometimes change lifestyles and they expect to bring some of the old lifestyle with them. And that can't always be done.
How do you respond to critics like Joel Kotkin, who dismiss this idea that cities are coming back by saying, oh, it's just a tiny blip in the statistics?
Well, it could be a blip, but it could also be a snowball rolling downhill. I think my answer to Joel, for whom I have a lot of respect, is that things happen one step at a time. Cities are not going to change dramatically overnight. They are changing rather noticeably. And I think he would argue that until you get families with small children and functioning and decent schools in central cities, you won't really have an urban revival. Well, my personal opinion is that education is not the first piece of the puzzle. It's closer to the final piece. First, you have singles and couples, gays, moving into the center of cities. Then you have people with very small children who stay for a while. Then they put their children in the elementary school, and then you will have an urban area that is family-oriented. Lower Manhattan has a larger average household size than the rest of Manhattan. But does that mean that people with four kids who now live out in the exurbs are all going to be flocking into the city in the next few years? No, of course not. More people have moved to the suburbs in this decade than have moved into the city. So, I mean, Joel is right about the numbers. Where I think he's wrong is about the significance of all this, and particularly the significance of a young urban elite gathering together in proximity in the center of American cities. I think that's very important.
As executive editor of Governing Magazine, you have a unique window into the world of cities. Tell me, what are the most pressing issues for cities over, say, the next 36 months?
Money, taxes. You know, in the last recession, almost a decade ago, states had a hard time, but property values were so high that cities did fairly well. Now we're having falling property values, the property tax is declining as a source of revenue for cities, and so their fiscal problems are much worse than they were in the previous recession. That's not going to last forever, but it's a big problem now. I think almost every day you'll see a story from Chicago or Philadelphia or wherever it is, that the budget's in the red by, you know, significant amount of money. This is a different type of recession and one that is hitting cities harder than previous ones did.
Clearly the money issue is number one, and it will be for some time. And anything else that's rising to the top?
Well, related to money is transportation. People move into central cities in part because, well, they don't necessarily want to commute as far as they've been commuting, but they also want transportation that works and is frequent and gets them where they want to go. One of the attractive things about Lower Manhattan is you can get anywhere on the subway. You've got to want to take the subway, but that's in itself not nearly as problematic as it was two decades ago. So I would say transportation, the main concerns that people have in moving back to a city, not in no particular order, trying to reestablish some form of physical community, some form of dense social life of the sort Jane Jacobs described, transportation, they've got to be able to get around, and safety. Right now, although crime rates are going up in some cities in America unevenly, it tends not to be random violence. So the specter of the middle-class person returning to the city and being attacked, I'm not saying that isn't ever happening, but it's not the concern that it once was. And so those are, I think, are the major issues. And then I would add to that, if we're going to have a real urban revival with much larger numbers, and one can debate that either way, central cities have to become much denser. There just aren't enough lofts and townhouses. So we're going to have to start building tall buildings in the center of cities, and a lot of people who've lived there for a while don't want to do that. I mean, there is a density issue that has to be faced.
Alan, it's been fun talking. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Alan Ehrenhalt is the executive editor of Governing Magazine, as well as the author of the book, The Lost City, The Forgotten Virtues of Community in America. He joined us from his offices in Washington, D.C. For the latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development, we turn to PlanEtizen's assistant editor, Nate Berg.
High-speed rail is not an American reality. Fast-moving trains connecting big cities and transit hubs are commonplace in Europe and Japan, but the idea hasn't really seemed to catch on in the U.S. That may soon change. In fact, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger recently approved a bill that will place a budget proposal on this November's ballot for a long-planned high-speed rail system between San Francisco and Los Angeles. And with gas prices rising all over the country, California isn't the only state looking to get into the high-speed game. USA Today reports that Florida Congressman John Mica has proposed a privately funded high-speed train connecting New York and Washington, D.C., one that travels faster than Amtrak's relatively fast Acela train. Other high-speed projects are also being planned or proposed in Maryland, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. Whether these projects move forward, however, could depend largely on what California voters say this November. And for the same reason more people are considering trains as a viable alternative to the car, many residents across the country are beginning to move back into urban areas. In Atlanta, this move back to the city from the suburbs has caused some rapid changes, as decaying industrial zones are transformed into lively urban areas in just a matter of years. To explain this trend, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution took a look at a neighborhood in the city's industrial Inman Park neighborhood. Over the course of just 4 years, the area went from an industrial ghost town to a full-on condo-lined, coffee shop-equipped neighborhood. And many other neighborhoods seem to be following on this path to regeneration. Infill development is occurring all over the city, and as a result, many say Atlanta's reputation as a capital of sprawl may begin to fade. And finally, anthropologists in South America have uncovered traces of a vast network of urban developments in the Amazon rainforest. These city forms date back to the year 1200 AD, and researchers are saying that they are organized into hierarchies of cities, smaller villages, and rural areas. Study author anthropologist Michael Heckenberger of the University of Florida in Gainesville says that the city forms show a broad grid structure, indicating a type of controlled regional development. According to an article from National Geographic News, the hub-and-spoke structure of the city cores and radiating roads indicate a broad network of villages that could have housed more than 50,000 people. Heckenberger says the city forms bear a striking resemblance to British planner Ebenezer Howard's Garden Cities and could offer some good advice on redeveloping the Amazon sustainably. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with author Harry Boyd. His latest book, The Citizen Solution, is about re-inspiring citizenship and community involvement. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Harry Boyd is a veteran of the social justice movement. He worked with civil rights leaders in the 60s as a field secretary for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and is the co-founder of the Center for Democracy and Citizenship in Minneapolis. His new book is The Citizen Solution. Harry, I love your embrace of the word citizen. What does that word imply about our obligations and our outlook?
Well, I would say it implies something about obligations, outlook, and agency, the three things. But it certainly, in terms of obligations, means recognizing that we are responsible not only for our own individual lives, but for the society that we help to create. So the citizen perspective pays attention to the world around us and recognizes that even when we pretend not to have an impact, we do have an impact. We have an impact on other people. We have an impact on the job, the workplace, or the school that we're in. We have an impact on the neighborhood we live in. And we have an impact on the world. So there's a claiming of responsibility. I would say that's the obligation piece, recognizing that we're responsible. We can't pretend not to be responsible. And then the outlook is that it's a perspective of connectedness, both to other people and to the future and to the past. I mean, I think it's a recognition of what Martin Luther King called our inescapable network of mutuality. And then agency, I would say, involves a recognition that we shape our environment and we can get better at shaping our environment and working with other people to shape our environment in constructive ways, that there's skills and the habits and capacities to develop about that.
This presidential campaign seemed to begin as a citizen movement. Is it still?
Well, I think it has potential to be hugely important in American history and kind of channeling and crystallizing and helping to revitalize a sense of citizenship and citizen agency. It was reflected in the Obama campaign. It was reflected in the theme, Yes, We Can, which really comes from the organizing experiences that Barack Obama had and also that has spread invisibly across the country. I would distinguish the organizing experiences which have been important to the Obama campaign from what most people think of when they think of citizen action, at least on a large scale, which is more mobilizing. You've got a preset agenda, you have a script, you have an enemy that usually is the target. People are very familiar with mobilizing, where you rally the troops to go after somebody that's already been defined and around an approach that's already been scripted. But the important thing about organizing is that there's much more self-activity. There's much more people working through what to do. So I think the Obama campaign itself has aspects of a citizen movement. And then in general, I think people today, this election, have been activated on a huge scale. I mean, young people under the age of 30 are voting in twice the numbers they ever have before.
Why do you think people seem ready to engage again?
I think several things are at work. And this is especially true for the millennial generation, those born after 75. Now, we had a discussion last night at a local drugstore, carries on the old Hubert Humphrey tradition called Tom's Drugstore. Tom Gupta, an Indian guy who heard Humphrey talk about his father's drugstore. And so we had a good group. It was a lot of young people there, and then, you know, older folks, people of different ages. As a group, the young adults, they said, before 9/11, we thought people were going to take care of the problems of the world. And then suddenly we had a realization that's not going to happen. If there are problems, we better get active. And so I think they're younger adults have been looking for an opportunity to really enter a public world. And they've also been, in a sense, looking for political leadership that will call them to action. So what they said about the Obama campaign was that there was a major shift from the idea that a politician is saying, I will fix things, which they didn't really believe, to, yes, we can, that we need to work together on problems.
I think this is a very interesting point of tension in Democrat politics today, perhaps Republican as well, but certainly on the Democrat side. In the primaries, you had one candidate, Hillary Clinton, offering this laundry list of prescriptions, you know, the way in which government was going to fix things. And then you had this contrasting campaign that said, yes, we can, we're the change we've been waiting for, which, of course, has been widely ridiculed. And where are the prescriptions? Where are the policies? You know, what are you going to do? I mean, there seems to be this generational split going on. Sort of the older generation, or at least perhaps traditional media that speaks for an older generation, seems to demand those policy prescriptions. What will government do for you? And then there's this sort of younger generation saying, what is it we're going to organize to do for ourselves and with government, not waiting on government? What is that the way you see it?
Absolutely. I think there are different camps and different age groups, but generally younger adults want to be called to a new civic task. They're worried about the problems of the world, but they also think there's something stirring deep in the American psyche, that there's a struggle for the soul of the nation, that's a question of, are we going to work together to address the challenges to build a flourishing democratic society, or are we going to continue in our bubbles on our kind of individual past to do as well as we can without actually thinking about the larger context? So young people are really open to the message that we have to learn to work together. And one of the themes that came out last night in Tom's Drugstore was we just have lived in bubble cultures. We've lived in a iPod world, as one said. But we really need to learn to work with people who are unlike us, who we may disagree with on issues. That's something we have to do. It's a very strong sense of that.
You have this wonderful history of working with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and of course, which was all about community organizing. And there was such a clear moral call involved in all of that. I mean, the basic human rights, which were not available to those of the wrong color in the wrong parts of the country. And so, I mean, there was an urgency and a morality about that. Do you feel the same passion now, or is it more an intellectual endeavor? I mean, how would you compare these two eras?
The continuities are important to note, even the historical continuities. So the people who shaped me as a young man when I was working for Southern Christian Leadership Conference and what were called the citizenship schools of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, church basements and beauty parlors, those folks like Ella Baker, great African-American woman, and Bayard Rustin, who was an educator in nonviolence. And they came out of the late 30s, the same period that Saul Alinsky, who created the organizing tradition that shaped Barack Obama, came out of. So there's a lot of continuity there in that, in the roots of the organizing that took place in the 1930s. And even the song that we sang was We Are the Ones We've Been Waiting For, which was has been a theme song in the Obama campaign. Or, not a song, but a phrase. Actually, it drove me crazy at one point when media was saying this was a flaky New Age concept. Where in the world did he get that? Well, it's actually a very specific referent. It was the Citizenship Schools of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Dorothy Cotton used to sing it across the South. You know, there are different ways of looking at what the movement was about. The freedom movement in the 60s was about the terrible evil of segregation. It was also about powerlessness and sense that people were living in a world that couldn't be changed and that communities were deeply divided and marred. They were flawed by the segregated world. I would say today, the deepest issue people feel is the collapse of what I would call a public community. And organizing is really about building public communities, building relationships across lines of difference to get things done. We have a lot of focus in our society on private communities of many different kinds, kind of bubble cultures, in fact. And even the kind of illusion of intimacy takes place on a massive scale on television game shows and so forth. But what we've really lost are places where we could learn to work together with people who we disagreed with, who came from different backgrounds, on common problems. And there are a multiplying number of problems, from global warming to crime to education to health issues, which can only be solved by people learning to work together and developing the sense of power and really giving clout to the democratic values that are the foundation of working together. So I think that's what people feel. I think there's still a process of developing a common language. But that was true for the South. I mean, if you look at the late 50s, when I was still a kid, nobody in the South said they were in a movement. There wasn't a sense of movement. There were some important local campaigns like the bus boycott, and there was Little Rock, and there were stirrings in different towns. And Ella Baker, who was the chapter secretary for the NAACP, so she knew what was happening with a kind of bird's eye view. I mean, she had a sense that there was a movement gelling, but nobody in the South thought there was a movement. It took a while for the language and the themes and the spirit of the movement to really generate a sense of common movement.
It's really hard for me to imagine, Harry, people who were experiencing segregation and all that came with that, that they would have found time in their lives to come to a meeting, to a citizenship school to learn to be a citizen. I mean, what in the world did they think they were going to get out of that? I mean, really, that, you know, it's like, oh, do I have to go to a meeting and, you know, hold hands and swing and sway? What, you know, sing kumbaya? What is it that, you know, what's the process that will get me there the quickest, right? I mean, that's our society today. So how in the heck did you get these people to citizenship schools?
And people usually get active in public work, not through moral exhortation. We didn't go out and say, this is good for you, or this is your civic duty. And people were usually mad. They were mad at the slights, the everyday slights of a segregated society, the water fountains that they couldn't drink in, or the ways they were humiliated, the blacks were humiliated on the encounters with whites and white power structure. Mad that they couldn't have their kids go to a better school, mad at the second class textbooks, mad at job discrimination.
So what was your pitch? Did you say, come to this school, citizenship school, and figure out how you're going to fix these problems?
Yeah. I mean, the issue was not people's motivation. People had a lot of issues they were concerned about. They wanted a better life, and they wanted a more dignified life. They wanted respect. I mean, I would say a hugely important question in the South, which is a question today for most people. If you ask kids what they think in schools, they think they don't get respect. Well, in the South, it was dramatic. African Americans felt they weren't respected as human beings or dignity there. But the real issue was hope. People didn't think you could make change. There was a tremendous sense of fatalism and powerlessness. There was a kind of weight of history, and which is why the role of young people was so important. And in Birmingham, there was a very interesting moment in 1963 when the king was about to give up, and the older adult black community felt it was too dangerous. They were saying, we have to call off the demonstrations. And King finally agreed to the arguments of James Bevel and Diane Nash, who were young staff people in SCLC, that young people should be allowed in the demonstrations, which was really the first time that teenagers and kids were allowed in demonstrations. And, you know, radio played a really important role, speaking of our conversation now. The black DJs across Birmingham really touted the movement and created a freedom spirit, and young people just poured out of schools into the demonstrations. And the whole mood of the black community changed as people developed a sense of possibility and hope that they hadn't had. It was really a transformative moment. It was probably the key to the whole movement. There was probably that pivot in the spring of 63, which was, of course, also the time that King wrote Letter from a Birmingham Jail when he went to jail.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with author, organizer, and activist Harry Boyd about the tips and tactics for creating civic engagement found in his latest book, The Citizen Solution. You write in your wonderful book that we undervalue the talents of poor people. Explain what you mean by that. What talent? And what talents are we overlooking? And how do we then bring those into play?
As a society, institutions have come to undervalue the talents of poor people, but also all sorts of people. We have kind of credentialitis, where people think, you know, unless you have a degree, you can't speak about an issue. I worked with the Star Tribune, the paper in the Twin Cities, a few years ago on something called a citizen project, where they brought together people from across the state to talk about issues. And the guys who set up the survey said, you know, we had a lot of problems getting people here because they said they'd never taken a course in democracy. They didn't have the right credentials. But I think we live in a society which has really gone crazy on credentials and has come to devalue practical experience, local knowledge, community wisdom, the values that are passed down from elders, cultural knowledge. So, we have a good example that I tell in the book, The Citizen Solution. We have a partnership with new immigrants in a neighborhood in St. Paul, the west side of St. Paul, an old immigrant neighborhood. And in recent years, Hmong people have come from Asia, Southeast Asia, and Africans have come from East Africa, and Latinos have come up from Latin America, settled in the west side. And we've created a partnership called the Jane Addams School for Democracy, based on the old tradition of Hull House in Chicago. Jane Addams was a great leader working with immigrants in the early 20th century. And it's built around the idea that actually immigrants, even if they don't have formal education, have a lot to bring to the democracy. They have cultural knowledge, they have spirit, they have energy, they have dedication. They have a belief in democracy, actually. One of the great things about working with immigrants is their themes like freedom and democracy and citizenship are fresh ideas. They're a real passion. So we've had more than 1,500 college students from the University of Minnesota and other area colleges work with the immigrants in the Jane Addams School over the last decade, on all sorts of projects, sometimes studying for the citizenship test, sometimes mutual language education, sometimes community projects. There's work across the West Side so that the whole community is claiming responsibility for educating kids, the library and the businesses and the Girl Scouts. But in that work, the students go through an orientation, which is really kind of unlearning what they've learned in a lot of their formal school, which is that everyone is a teacher and everyone's a learner. So even if they're seniors in college or graduate students at the University of Minnesota, they can learn a lot from an elderly Hmong woman who never had formal education. And not only in individual terms, there is individual learning, but there's also cultural terms. So there's a depth and a vitality of cultural life. There's extended family patterns and the sense of kinship and vitality in family life. When students think about that, they're really quite blown away. It can change their life. We see it a lot. And so that's what I mean, that the normal processes of credentialing of the kind of the best and the brightest society really have come to undervalue people's talents and contributions.
I want to come back to this notion, Harry, of citizenship, a citizen movement. We often think of that as volunteerism or doing good works. Yes, and I know that you make a distinction, a big distinction, between volunteerism and citizenship. Explain that distinction.
We've always been interested in our work at the Center for Democracy and Citizenship in stories that are citizens doing what we call self-organized work, defining problems that people are concerned about, not out of a kind of abstract idea of doing good, but actually out of concrete interests, issues, you know, local crime, I tell the story of veterans being integrated into communities as citizens across the state and seeing that the experiences of veterans is really preparing people for civic leadership. So there's a kind of self-interest dimension in stories that I describe. People come to them because they care about them out of their own interest, not selfishness, but not do-goodism. But then there's another dimension, which is the strongest traditions of citizenship in the United States have been about work. In fact, even things that today would be called volunteerism were once called work. A great women's organization in the 19th century, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, it had a mission not only to work on temperance, but to create hospitals and libraries and study circles. I mean, it was a remarkable organization. But her book was called The Work and Workers of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. So there was a focus on productive civic activity that made a lasting mark through which people really built the country and built communities. That was sometimes unpaid, but public work of building communities was often paid work. It was often the citizen teacher who saw themselves as not only a classroom figure, but actually a civic leader in the life of a community, or the citizen businessman, or the citizen journalist in the great tradition of citizen journalists.
So is that a tradition that can be revived?
I think we have to revive it. And you can see some ferment now. In fact, I tell stories in the book about professionals who've come to think of themselves as citizens, not simply experts fixing people. So one set of stories I tell in the Citizen Solution is a colleague, Bill Doherty, who is a family social scientist and family therapist. But over the last decade, he shifted from doing therapy for families to working with families of all backgrounds, including a lot of suburban families, on the forces which are putting families at risk these days. So the kind of hyper-scheduling, overactivity in suburbs that just drives people crazy. They never have time for family meals because they're always taking their kids to this or that, this ballet or this sports activity. It's a good example of what happens when a professional stops thinking of themselves as an expert fixing people and starts thinking more as an organizer working with people.
You write about losing our connection to place and this notion of cosmopolitans who are, in effect, global citizens, and then there are locals. And you say you think there is a new class emerging who would be considered local cosmopolitans. And I think that's a very interesting notion, and it ties to this concept that you raise of stewards of place. And I think in today's world, we are so desperately in need of people who feel they are stewards of their local place. What have you learned about this and perhaps how we can have more local cosmopolitans self-identify in that way and then act in that way?
I think this is a very important new development that actually is one of the forces behind the signs of a new movement, a citizen movement. I would say local cosmopolitans are people who care about where they live, and they care about it out of their own interests. They want to have a healthy place to live and to work and to raise children and to leave a legacy. But they're not in narrow groups, so they create connections across lines of difference. One of the things about the book, in fact, is that I was wanting to tell the other side of the story. There have been a number of works in recent years about the decline of democracy. But last year, this nationally mandated National Conference on Citizenship, in its annual Civic Health Index, found several positive trends which they hadn't noticed before. And one of them really was about cosmopolitan locals, although they didn't use that term. But it was people who have a strong commitment to place, who work across lines of difference on community problems, who have a strong investment in making their communities better. 36 million Americans, and then there was significant evidence that many more people would like to have opportunities to develop that kind of outlook, those skills, those habits. And I would say cosmopolitan locals are people who have a strong connection to farmers markets or to creating locally grown businesses or to creating public spaces and libraries, which are community centers, and reconnecting education, schools to the communities in which they're located.
Well, it would certainly be exciting to see that. And I think one of the questions, for me at least, that you raise is, how do we encourage that?
Well, I would say pay attention. Now, there are a lot of dimensions, including a mayor saying, as Elizabeth Couts, a suburban mayor in the Twin Cities, said, there are a lot of problems in Burnsville, and I can't fix them. I can work with people, I can convene people, I can redesign government agencies to be partners with the communities in Burnsville. But she didn't pander, and she hated the concept of citizen as customer. She said, if our citizens are our customers, we're not going to get anything done in Burnsville. To really create a healthy, vital community in Burnsville, we have to learn to work together, and the mayor can play an important role in that. But in addition, I think we have to look much more carefully at our educational system. Is education just generic? Is it creating abstract knowledge? Or is it actually preparing students to understand, to know about, to care about the places? I would also say that this is true for higher education, which tends to set the pattern, which I think is one of the reasons the regional universities have a lot of potential, that you take any field, any profession, teaching or engineering or medicine, we need to have education that teaches people to think much more contextually, much more about the places they work, in addition to the particular skills of their profession, and also to add into their professional training skills of working with people. So rather than a narrow intellectual specialty, how do you work with a neighborhood around where you're going to put a bridge or a sewage system? Or so the skills of collaborative work and the skills of understanding the place where you work, higher education has to do a much better job of that.
Well, Harry, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Ah, this is a pleasure, Carol.
Harry Boyd is the founder and co-director of the Center for Democracy and Citizenship in Minneapolis. His latest book is The Citizen Solution. Everybody forgets things now and again, but what happens if a small oversight can be a matter of life or death? CityView's commentator Walker Smith says sometimes even the latest technology can't take the place of due diligence.
To save the lives of more patients, hospitals need look no further than making lists. You'd think that doctors are so experienced that the basics are permanently etched into their brains. Muscle memory, if nothing else. Yet the surprising fact is that the basics are so elementary and routine that they are often forgotten, and with dire consequences. Dr. Peter Pronovost of Johns Hopkins Medical School has shown in repeated tests that using checklists can dramatically reduce the chances that patients suffer from the ill effects of overlooked procedures. There is nothing high-tech about checklists. They list rudimentary things, such as making sure the doctor is dealing with the right patient, or has washed his or her hands, or has put on sterile gloves. These are basic things that all doctors know to do, yet unfortunately they are often forgotten. So having and enforcing a checklist to make sure these procedures are remembered can yield extraordinary results. Dr. Pronovost stumbled across the need for checklists in 2001, and in 2003 validated the use of checklists with a series of overwhelmingly convincing tests at the more than 100 intensive care units he worked in Michigan. New York City's 11 public hospitals have had such checklists since 2005. Over that period of time, central line bloodstream infections in adult intensive care units have dropped by 55%. Ventilator-associated pneumonia has fallen 78%. In the frenzied atmosphere of today's high-tech medical care, the simple, mundane things that checklists can ensure often get neglected. It's technology that gets all the attention, technology that's supposed to rush in and save the day, the million-dollar machine or the miracle drug, not soap and water. It's not that doctors don't believe in basic hygiene. It's just that in the rush of the moment, they sometimes forget. And this leads to problems that even the latest technology cannot fix. Basic mistakes overwhelm intricate systems. We live in a high-tech world. Most, if not all of us, would be lost without our daily dose of the internet. Everything we do, from driving a car to using a credit card or watching TV, depends upon a vast and complicated technological infrastructure. For many modern things, like the latest cars and computers, tinkering is a pastime now dominated by brainy geeks. Ordinary hobbyists no longer have the sophistication or training required. But for all of our technological sophistication, we can still be easily defeated by the most run-of-the-mill things. It only takes a little low-tech snag to bring down a whole lot of high-tech systems. The answer is not to pile on more high-tech, but to go back to fundamentals, to go back to basics, like a checklist. There's nothing wrong with technology. It's just that technology is not always a panacea. Indeed, we could do with a little less technology every now and then, especially when it comes to making sure that we're even using technology correctly to begin with. So the next time you're firing up your latest gadget, take a moment and ask yourself whether you've checked off everything you need to do first. Technology is of little help unless you do. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. For more information about our guest and their work, point your browser to our website, smartcityradio.com. You'll find links to all the books and articles we mention in the show, along with an archive of all of our past shows, and another way to get in touch with us. Just click on the contact button. You can also sign up for our newsletter or subscribe to our podcast and take Smart City with you wherever you go. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. We had additional engineering help from Jessica Flores and Todd Melby. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer, and no, he was not allowed in the Twin Cities this week. I'm Carol Coletta.